Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to MitoAction's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Rosanna Sanchez Russo, assistant professor in pediatric and metabolic geneticist at Emory Genetics, is with us to share understanding rare genetic variants. What do my results really mean? My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the patient support coordinator at MitoAction and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in the space today, but it is really helpful if you put all of your questions for the presenter in the Q&A section and not the chat. This helps me to stay better organized when we kick off our Q&A time at the end of today's presentation. We will do our best to get through as many questions as possible. In our Mito community, we recognize that we are rare, but when our genetic variant is shared by only a handful of individuals worldwide, what does it mean for diagnosis, treatment, and research? In this session, we will explore the complexities of interpreting ultra-rare genetic mutations, especially in the context of mitochondrial disease. How do clinicians and geneticists determine whether a novel or rare variant is pathogenic? What frameworks are used to classify variants, and how do phenotypic data contribute to this process? Can a variant of uncertain significance or a VUS eventually be reclassified as clinically meaningful? Today, Dr. Rosanna Sanchez Russo will help us unpack these questions and more. And as we address individuals in the mitochondrial disease community who truly are the rare among the rare. So without further ado, I have the privilege of introducing Dr. Rosanna Sanchez Russo. Dr. Sanchez Russo's lifelong dream was to become a clinical geneticist. Her career has been driven by a commitment to advancing early diagnosis and care for genetic diseases, with a strong focus on metabolic disorders. After completing her pediatric residency at Miami Children's Hospital, she trained in genetics and medical biochemical genetics at Emory University, where she now serves as assistant professor in pediatric and metabolic geneticist. She led the highest enrolling site in a pivotal clinical trial for arginase-1 deficiency, contributing to a phase 3 trial published in eClinical Medicine, which supported therapy approval in Europe. She also participated in the 3Q29 Emory project, improving clinical guidance for this rare genetic syndrome. In addition to her clinical work, she trains and mentors future geneticists as program director of the Medical Genetics and Combined Pediatric Genetics Residency programs. Dr. Sanchez is passionate about understanding the whys behind a patient's complex symptoms at a molecular level. The reality is that few genetic conditions have approved therapies, but she is passionate about helping close that gap by being an investigator in clinical trials and patient registries, collaborating with experts worldwide while partnering with patients and families to tailor care to their unique needs. Dr. Sanchez, we are honored to have you in this space and appreciate your passion, willingness to educate, and the love and the care and concern that you show for our community and all the patients that you have. We just really, really appreciate you coming into this space today, and thank you for everything that you do every day for your patients.
Hi, everyone who's here and those who may watch these later. My name is Rosanna Sanchez, and I'm super grateful to be here. I'm super grateful to Stephanie for having included me in this conversation. We may end up here with more questions than answers sometimes, and I think that's okay. My goal is that we can work together in trying to understand some of the complexities around interpreting rare genetic variants. And is it okay if I start sharing my screen?
Yes, go for it.
Perfect. Let me see if I get this right this time around.
That's
Can you see me?
perfect.
Great, perfect. The first thing that I wanted to say is that I do not have specific conflicts of interest for this particular presentation. I do work in clinical trials. I work for some labs in the past, helping with some patient results, but not currently. And I have de-identified the results or the data that I'm showing is previously published or shown with patient permission. So I wanted to set the stage with this slide, and I do not think that I have to convince anyone here about how important it is to get to a proper diagnosis. I think that's what ultimately leads to medical management. But as Stephanie was mentioning, very few rare diseases have an approved, let's say, medical management to this point. And some of the common patient and family questions that I get every day, and I put patients and families here, but honestly, they come from myself and they come from other specialties too. They usually include, how did it happen? What can we expect? Is there a treatment or a cure? Who else in the family is at risk? That's a big one. And for me to be able to even try to start answering some of those, the fundamental question really is, what is the diagnosis? That's where we start. And so that's one of the big purposes, I think, of the medical genetics evaluations and why geneticists do what we do. So I would say that clarification of what we call etiology, which just means what is the cause of a disease or the symptoms, is the main goal. But with that in mind, if I can get to that goal, it's kind of like opening now all the literature that is available to that one condition. Even if there's not a lot of information that I can now use to try to give some prognosis or expected clinical courses to a family to discuss those recurrent risks, can this happen again, to refine treatment options if they're available, and even to avoid unnecessary or redundant diagnostic test. And I think that's important in the context of mitochondrial diseases, because I've seen many people having done a muscle biopsy when sometimes, if we have a conclusive diagnosis, that may not be necessary for surveillance too. When I have this little patient journey from NORD, I don't think anyone here probably hasn't gone through some of these, just starting to look at the symptoms, doing your own research, first visits. But the main point that I wanted to do with this is that many times where things coalesce and become a little bit more clear is here in genetic testing. And what we've learned about genetic testing for specifically for mitochondrial diseases is that this has now become the gold standard. And so, in getting to that question that I posed fundamentally, what is the diagnosis? Genetic testing is key. And so, for us to even start thinking of that, the first thing that I start thinking about is, how do these genes affect health and disease? And so, many of you already may know this, but within each of our cells, and we don't even know how many cells are in each of our bodies, but we presume maybe billions or trillions, there's DNA. And the nuclear DNA is organized in what we call the chromosomes. And these chromosomes look like this if we were looking at them under the microscope. They have different shapes and sizes, though. And that's where the genes are contained. And the genes are organized in a linear fashion on those chromosomes. So the way that I think about them is like they're books in a library of books that are in the main, maybe, library building, but they contain these stretches of DNA that we call genes that have letters organized in specific fashions, giving a message to the body. What they're trying to do is give an instruction to make, usually, what we call a protein, different from the ones that we eat in food. And those proteins are the ones that have some sort of function. It could be a structural function, making something within the cell, or it could be something like an enzyme. I think that you may have heard that term before. And enzymes are types of proteins that just convert one thing into another, so making a product. And those are very important for mitochondrial diseases. So if there's differences at the chromosome level, like missing pieces of information, then some of the genes in that area may be missing or extra. Or if there's typos at the DNA level, where those letters are, that can cause differences in how those proteins then are expressed. And that's how we've been thinking about the correlations between our DNA and causing disease. We cannot forget about the mitochondrial DNA in all of these, because mitochondria have their own DNA. It looks a little different from the ones on the main library that I was telling you about. It's like having many different extra booklets in a different building set within the cell. And for us, in the context of what we'll be talking about, it's important to look at both. And so, with that being said, what is genetic testing? Genetic testing for me, and in the context of what I do, is a specific medical test. I hear from many patients and families asking me about like 23andMe, which may not be around for some time, ancestry test results. Those, I think about them more as recreational genetic testing. And the reason for that is because they may not be very sensitive types of testing, and they may use technologies that may be a little different. So in the medical context, the type of genetic testing that at least I use in the clinic go through certified labs for genetic testing, and they usually have, different steps. The sample collection that is shown in this graph is the blood work, but we can do genetic testing from a cheek swab is the most common one that I use right now. From saliva, we can use tissue samples. And so we have to extract the DNA from the cells that we get, and then it goes through sequencing. The new technology is called next generation sequencing, or NGS, so you may hear that. But even after those steps, there's more. There's a lot of analysis that we'll be talking about today. So there's a lot of bioinformatic pipelines to be able to look at those variants, compare it to references, and then report it out in the context of the clinical features of the patient that is in front of us or their family history. And so it's like sequencing is like this way of finding changes at the DNA level. And that applies both for the mitochondrial DNA, but also for the nuclear DNA that I just showed you. And so I don't think that all genetic tests are made the same. So choosing the right genetic test is very important. And one of the things that I think you already know about mitochondrial diseases is that they're very heterogeneous, both in the organ systems that are involved, even within a same family with the same variants, but also the severity of those symptoms in different people. And so I don't think of genetic testing as one size fits all. I try to look at the clinical presentation to try to guide the type of testing that I'm doing. In this slide, you're seeing different types of genetic testing with some pros and cons. I'm just using this as an example. But for instance, if I'm seeing a child with a condition called cystic fibrosis, it's a disease that affects our lungs and some other body parts. That one only has one gene associated with it. So I may not need to do a whole exome or whole genome to be able to diagnose a child with that condition from the genetic aspect. But for conditions like mitochondrial diseases, where there's a lot of overlap and sometimes other testing may not be refined enough to give me answers, I may have to go with a broader genetic test. So very often, tests like whole exome sequencing or whole genome sequencing are done, where we're not looking at one of those stretches of DNA, we're looking at thousands of them in a single test. And I'll go a little further with some of these, but what the endpoint of that is to find a genetic variant that we know is disease causing. I'm introducing this term to you all called pathogenic, that then alters or changes the function of those proteins I was showing you, that then causes changes in the body that then leads to the genetic disorder. So let me give you the example of one of the most common tests that is currently ordered, which is called whole exome sequencing. Some people will call it only exome sequencing. We oftentimes in the clinic just call it WES. What we're doing with this type of testing is analyzing the coding regions. So the coding regions are those areas of DNA that I expect are coding for a protein. But if you look at it in a different way, that's only 1 to 2% of the whole DNA we have in our cells. So it's a very small part of the whole, which we call the genome. And a genome is now a test that we can also offer clinically. It's just much broader, more expensive, and sometimes not approved by insurance. We think right now, and this will probably change, that 85% of those disease-causing variants that I called pathogenic are in those coding areas, which is why this is a great test to start off with. It can take months for us to get results. We do have an expedited version for very sick people, and it can lead to the potential for new gene discoveries. So I think that's one of the things that may be interesting to people. The difference in analyzing the exome and the genome is that the genome can look in between certain areas of genes that the other one can't, and areas around the genes. I think about it as if I had a book and I can see the letters of the book, but there's other things from the book that are important. the spacing between the books, the periods or exclamation marks that still give sense to the meaning of the book. So with the genome, I'm able to look at all of that spacing also. Now, if I said something like that in the context of anyone that I see through the door with birth differences or developmental delays, not specifically for mitochondrial diseases, what would be the detection rate? We think it's around 25 to 30%. And I think what's more important for people to know is we think it may change direct clinical management right now, only in 5%. That means like starting a new medication, doing a specific surgery. But it may lead to additional studies in around 54% that may include things like doing an ultrasound of the kidney or a heart ultrasound to help with the care of the patient. And this would also include, giving referrals. Now, different studies will give different numbers because the way that you're looking at the information may be different, and the value that people put to these additional tests may be different too. Now, we talk about these tests, and when I think about it, imagine that I have those books that I was telling you about, and there's parts that I can't read yet. So reanalyzing the data that is there as I learn this language better can also improve the rate of the diagnosis. So we think that over a 3-year period, that detection rate can improve by 10%. And that's because, statistically speaking, we think there's around 250 new gene disease associations that come up in that time period, and around 9,000 new variant disease associations reported each year, which is a huge number. The other thing that can help us with this, if you see this little graph, is having other family members to test, and we'll go through that a little bit more. And so this is one of the studies where I got some of that data from. The current recommendation is probably to reanalyze some of these within 18 to 24 months. So for people who may be here today and don't have a diagnosis but have had this type of testing, and this can apply for whole genome sequencing too, then reanalyzing the data can be very powerful. So how about genetic testing for, and I was, very specific in putting primary mitochondrial disorders in this title, and bolding it. How about genetic testing for primary mitochondrial disease? I think that's one of the main things that we're here to talk about today. And DNA testing has become the new gold standard for the diagnosis of these conditions. The difficulty has been that there's not a one genetic cause for mitochondrial diseases. Like I was giving you the example for cystic fibrosis, there's one gene with this disease. Now, the clinical presentation may still vary, but there's only one gene that I have to look at. With primary mitochondrial diseases, there's over 250 genes that I could find. This number may already be not outdated at this day and age. And the detection rate is around 50%. But it's around 50% if I have a good clinical presentation that I have a high suspicion for these conditions. Now, because we know that these variants, these pathogenic variants in these protein coding genes in either genome, the ones that we were talking about before, the nuclear one or the mitochondrial one, can lead to mitochondrial diseases, then oftentimes if I do an exome, I'm doing a whole exome and the mitochondrial DNA sequencing, or I'm trying to do a genome, which would include the mitochondrial DNA sequencing. Practice will vary, and the clinical indications for testing will vary depending on where you're from. So I cannot make a blanket statement, right? And if you ask different people, their considerations for different types of testing will also be different. So I'm mostly here, want to do that caveat of telling you, I'm mostly telling you what I would do in my own clinical practice. What you see in front of here is an actual result of a patient of mine, where what we found was a positive result. This was exome-based on an infant who had a very severe clinical presentation with developmental delays and low muscle tone. And what we found was pathogenic variants you see here in the classification. On both copies of this gene called SERF1, we all have two copies, one from our mom and one from our dad. And he happened to have two copies of it causing a mitochondrial type of disease. This specific gene, how it causes disease, is one we call, in a way, that we call autosomal recessive inheritance. And so the way that this is depicted here on this graph is that if we all have two copies of that gene, the father, the biological father, may be carrying one of those genes that is not working as we expect, and mom may be carrying one. Because they have the backup, they don't have symptoms of that disease, but they have a chance of passing the both of them the working copy, both of them the non-working copy, or one and one. There's a 25% chance of both of them passing the non-working copy onto their children. That's what we call autosomal recessive inheritance. The reason why I wanted to specifically mention that is because right now, the majority of the primary mitochondrial diseases that we see have this type of inheritance. And many of them that are from the nuclear mitochondrial DNA actually present in pediatric patients. How about the mitochondrial DNA sequencing? Remember that I was telling you of the two libraries, right? Like the broader library that has the DNA from both parents, that is the nuclear one. The mitochondrial one only comes from our moms. So that's why that specific one has maternal inheritance. I'll spare you the details, but basically what we think happens is the sperm needs the mitochondria to get into the egg to fertilize the egg, and it loses them. So then the egg is the one that has a lot of the parts of the cell, including the mitochondria. And so that's why we think there's maternal inheritance for that one. This is the result of another one of my patients who we did mitochondrial DNA sequencing at one of the labs. And you can see here there's one of these common variants that is known to be a pathogenic variant. But now I'm adding this additional information to complicate things further, because why not? And it's this heteroplasmy. And you see here it says 70% heteroplasmy of this pathogenic variant. So now you have two pieces of information here. You have that you have a variant that is known to be associated with disease, but you also have a percentage of how many of the mitochondria that were studied, and not all of them may be exactly the same, have this variant. So what is this heteroplasmy? Heteroplasmy is the existence of more than one mitochondrial DNA type in the same cell, tissue, or individual. This is actually a very common occurrence, both in variants that may be pathogenic or non-pathogenic. There's also homoplasmy, which is just one type of mitochondrial DNA in a tissue or individual. If we put it graphically here, you see this is presumably like the normal mitochondrial DNA, and this is the mutant that we now know as pathogenic. And for some conditions, you would expect that you would have symptoms if most of this mitochondrial DNA is abnormal or not working well. For some other conditions, you may have variations. There may be a threshold, a point in which the one that is not working well kind of takes over, and it's too much to allow that organ or system to work appropriately. To complicate things further, there's many mitochondria per cell, and there's many mitochondrial DNAs per mitochondria. So this number is sometimes hard to look at. And so I'm giving you then this example from one of my patients, where we performed these mitochondrial DNA in a urine sample here. I don't know if you can read that or not, because we knew they had the variant in blood, and we were trying to test other organ systems, because although this variant again is a disease-causing variant known as pathogenic, it was only present in around 40%. And it was both present in 40% in blood that we had tested, and also in urine. So we're looking at another tissue to see if it could be expressed a little different in other body parts. For some specific conditions, we know some of the expected thresholds. So if you have heard of mitochondrial encephalopathy with lactic acidosis and strokes, or also known as MELAS, the threshold tends to be around 60% of this level for us to call it disease causing, although the variant in itself may be pathogenic. So you need both the nature of the genetic variant to be a certain type and the level of heteroplasmy to be a certain number for us to be able to commit and say this is the reason for your symptoms. The reason why sometimes us clinicians don't want to commit is for many different reasons. But one of them that I think is one of the compelling ones is because they can have implications not just for the person in front of me. It may have implications for people around that person, including family members, and it may also get into their choosing to have or not have children. So imagine if I get it wrong, and that child may be wants to have children in the future, and that changes how they see that. Or someone decides to terminate a pregnancy because of these results. That has very, very huge implications for us as providers. And so sometimes we have to be a little comfortable with the uncertainty, which is very hard to do for us as well as you guys, for you guys more than us, but for us too. But sometimes we prefer to wait until we have levels of evidence high enough to commit to a diagnosis. So for this particular case I'm showing you here, we have not committed to a diagnosis because we don't think we've passed some of those thresholds. That doesn't mean that we don't offer some clinical care. If I think this variant may be associated with, just to put an example, heart disease, I would still check the heart, right? So although maybe I haven't committed to a diagnosis, I may still do some follow-up tests to make sure that there's no other implications. So let's talk a little bit more in detail about describing this variation that I've been talking about. I've already told you about some of the terminology that we use. And you probably saw my slides, some say mutation, and some of the graph that I took from other places may still say mutation. But then what we are using the most right now is variant to describe a change in the DNA. And we all have variants in our DNA. Because variant is just a comparison of how the sequence of the letters of my DNA compare to other people's. And we are all unique in our own way. Although if we compare to people, the majority will match. There's 3 billion letters in the alphabet of one of our sets of chromosomes. We think every single letter can be changed in the, I don't know, 7 billion people on planet Earth right now as we stand. So there's a lot of different variations. But the way that we clinically, for those reports, for the genetic test, report these variants is in different subtypes. We may call them pathogenic, and pathogenic are established disease-causing variants. So we're super confident they cause symptoms. They're usually, but have been seen in different people with the condition that are not related to each other. And that part of not being related to each other, although those relationships can help us support variants, the reason is because we share DNA with our family. So that different people have a variant doesn't give us enough information to just commit. But if different people from different families unrelated to each other have the same variant and the same clinical presentation, that gives us additional information. We call likely pathogenic something that we think probably causes disease. Numerically speaking, likely pathogenic, we think there's like around a 90% certainty that we got it right. How did the bioinformatics people get to that? I am not certain, but it's by weighing evidence, and we'll go through some of the things that they may weigh in. When we do not have enough information, we call it a variance, a variant of uncertain significance. So we have not committed to one side or the other. And I'll show you some examples from my patients. And then likely benign or benign is not expected to cause disease. Now, could some likely benign or benign variants be associated with traits that don't cause any symptoms? That is possible, but it's not affecting health per se. So it's not causing disease per se. This last one, this one they don't show in the report unless they're reclassifying something. So remember when I was telling you, oh, if I have an exome or a genome, in a few years I may reanalyze it. The reanalysis may be because it's a negative test or because I have an uncertain test and I want to get more data. These uncertain can be upgraded into a pathogenic or likely pathogenic and now become disease causing, or they can be likely benign or benign. So the reclassification can go either way. And all of that information to me can be helpful in the clinical setting. So what are these? Now we talked about variants, but what are rare variants? Rare variants are usually those that are uncommon. They're not oftentimes present in the general population. For us, something that is very common is usually about 1%. If something is very, very common, then we think it's less likely to cause disease. And the variants that we presume can be very rare are usually classified as pathogenic, likely pathogenic, or uncertain, a certain significance. If you look at an exome, this is a way that we can look at it maybe graphically. Something can be benign, likely benign, uncertain, likely pathogenic, or pathogenic. And if you look at the variant classification in anyone, if any one of us, there's around 25,000 benign variants that can be found in an exome. Likely benign around 90, uncertain 75, so a lot of uncertain variants. Too likely pathogenic and too pathogenic, and there's a range. And so we find a lot of variations for each exome that we do. So if we have a variant of uncertain significance, or maybe a likely pathogenic or other variants, there's a full interpretation process that has to come in through that. The first line of information that I have as a clinician is, what is your clinical presentation like, right? Like, what are the symptoms that you're having? And then sometimes I may have additional information about any lab work that someone has had. Imaging findings and like echocardiograms or brain MRI. So I'm trying to pull all of that information to try to one, choose the right test, two, narrow down a diagnosis if I can, but sometimes I cannot. And then three, interpret any variants that come from the test. And but there's other things that we can use. We can use analysis of the family. We can use more like biological information from organism, cellular, the specific gene or the specific variant, epidemiological, so is this a common change or not? So some of the steps may come up here, like let's do a family analysis, let's check for the rarity of the variant, let's see the predicted impact of the variant. You don't have to know all of these, unless maybe you're interested in looking a little further. Maybe do a literature review. Sometimes let's do research, let's try to do a functional validation. So let me show you this example from a kid that I've seen recently, who we sent an exome on. And what you can see right here, the impact of this says uncertain, and different reports will look a little bit different. But the main gene that we were concerned for is called CARS2, which is a transfer RNA that actually works within the mitochondria. And you see here, this is an actual report, so it has a lot of information. But you see over here that it says VUS, these variants of uncertain significance. So what we know is that the child had two variants of uncertain significance on this gene. And if I'm trying to look at this, like what additional information can I have? The family part, the segregation comes up. So I know mom has one variant and dad has the other variant. So that's one of the extra things that I'm looking at right here. I can also see here from this epidemiological data, this variant is very rare. They've never seen it before. So that's like giving me extra information. So when I'm looking at this, although it's like so esoteric to look at, I'm trying to pull out all of these little details to help me interpret it in the big context of someone in front of me. This is from the main paper from the American College of Medical Genetics and Molecular Pathology. And this is how they weigh in some of the information. And they have evidence to support a benign variant, but also for pathogenic. And there's more for pathogenic for the disease side than the benign side, if you see it here. So the way that I think about it is I'm putting this variant of uncertain significance in court, and I'm building a case. I can build evidence towards each side. Building evidence towards causing disease, or building evidence towards being benign? What may help me as a strong evidence that something could be benign? For instance, it's a very common variant in the population, so I don't expect it to cause disease. And what could, for instance, be a strong here or very strong is that this specific type of change is predicted by computational methods. I'll show you a little bit of that in a little bit, causing disease. And so I'm trying to build all this evidence. Again, I wanted to put this one again in the context of the person in front of me. For as a clinician, that part is very, very important to me. And so this is an example from a literature review of a similar case to that one. I'm going to go back so that you can see. I remember we're talking about this KARS2 gene. So I had uncertain variants. One was very rare, one was from mom, one was from dad. I'm looking at the patient's clinical presentation. So one of the things that I did with our great fellow was a literature review. So you can see this reported in JAMD, which is a great place to look at literature for metabolic diseases. It was published not very long ago in 2023. Some of the clinical presentation matched that of our patient. If you this I got from the article in itself, but I wanted to purposely show it because, you know, by allelic pathogenic variants, so disease-causing variants, one coming from mom and one from coming from dad in that recessive form that I was telling you about before, cause this mitochondrial type of OXPHOS condition. At this stage in 2023, only 8 unique variants have been reported in 7 people for this condition. Like, that's ultra rare. And now I have 2 more of these VUSs that I don't know what to do for. These people were doing the same things that we were doing. They were looking if the variants were segregating, like, oh, look, this one is coming from that. Oh, look, this one is coming from that. This is actually how we look at family tree. So the squares are male and the circles are female. And they looked at the variants, what the variants were. Where are they in the gene? I mean, this is probably more than what you guys want to know that we do, but and you can see I get excited about looking at this information too, because I'm really trying to figure it out. But the reality was, this was not enough. And these people ended up having to look at the evidence of the mitochondria not working well from taking cells from the patient. So this ended up being a research case. And so when I spoke with the family and with our fellow, we actually had to end up saying, hey, we may have to go that route too in this case. We just do not have enough evidence. And this is very, very rare. So it is probably very frustrating for many of you guys who are in the same boat. I think it is very frustrating for us too. And it is not always easy or fast to get to these answers. So one of the things that we can think about is looking beyond the results. There's exchanges between clinical and research communities. One of these examples is called Gene Matcher. And this is sometimes where we put our variants and our genes where we want to see if other people may have something similar and try to, that helps identify other people with rare phenotypes. And it can enable different connections between people. So this is one of the things that we can think of, for instance, for that case or many others that we see in the clinic. This is something that Stephanie brought up earlier about one of the things that I was involved with, and it's one of the highlights of my career. I would say what an amazing group of people. We were able to then see people with something called 3Q29 deletion, which is a deletion in the long arm of chromosome number 3 that includes a specific set of genes. We had many individuals coming actually from around the world to be studied. We were able to pull all the data and then put it together. And that is so important because it is a way for us to really study deeply a disease. And of course, for us as clinicians, that leads to publications, which is a gain for us. But it leads to such a deep understanding of all this information. So for some of those rare variants, research collaborations can be very impactful. For this specific one, there's a registry. I know many diseases have, not all of them, but many have registries. That is one of the things that when I get asked by families, what can I do? If there's a registry, you can join. What does that do? It tells us how things present over time. Many rare diseases, we are diagnosing people who have more severe symptoms first and early first. Like, are there pediatric patients? And if they're severe patients, they tend to be the first ones to get diagnosed. We know there's a spectrum for everything. So understanding that and how things move along time is very important. If people say, oh, you know what, let me get recontacted for variant reclassification through some of these, that can be very impactful because then you can reach out and you can participate in other things and engaging in data sharing. So that's a question I get a lot. People can choose or not to do it. It's your own decision, but I wanted to put it out there because I do get that question a lot. And then what was the best thing for me out of this is that we could put out there some recommendations for care. Are they a cure? Absolutely not. But I think it can improve the quality of life of people. And I cannot give value, of what it means for someone to get a diagnosis, but I think it can be very helpful for someone to end the diagnostic odyssey and then take the next steps on their own care, which now for these people with 3 to 9, I mean, okay, we can do this a diagnosis or have ongoing care. This is another example of one of my patients. This is not a mitochondrial disease. It's another recessive condition. But it is a little boy who presented with seizures and an abnormal brain MRI finding, and also has a recessive condition where there's also has variants in a gene that is associated with a recessive condition called ADSL. One of the things that we can do and we can offer for interpretation of results, and I posted here as a question, but I'm going to tell you what we did. So I'm going to tell you the answers, is that we were looking at these publicly available population databases to help with interpretation of variants. And so I was talking about how rare things are or how not rare. You're probably like, but where do you get that information? There's data sets where people have aggregated the data and put a lot of effort. They also aggregated based on populations. And so I think this comes up during our meetings as me getting a family tree and maybe saying, oh, do you know your ancestry or your ethnicity? We know race is not a biological, but a social construct, but we use sometimes race and ethnicity as proxies for ancestry because the way that some variants are interpreted are in the context of how common they are in a specific population. And so for many of these data sets, what they've done is that they have people who are usually about 50 years of age, who are still living, and who don't have very severe pediatric disorders because we wouldn't expect them to be in these data sets. So it's not exactly a control, but it kind of works as a control for us to be able to tell how common something is in a specific population. And so for that variant, for one of these variants that I was showing you here, I wanted to show you that I can use different tools too. So I'll input some of these tools and some of our databases to look at it. I also want to make sure that the lab interpretation, my interpretation, and other softwares are congruent to each other. So, I have these like VUS here. You see, I was showing you, it goes from benign to pathogenic. This data set also was congruent with the same interpretation of the variant. So now I'm looking how common is it in the population, and it is not very common, so it would be considered rare. But I'm also looking at some predictions. What do predictions mean? Imagine that it's like a technological way of the computer to try to filter if the variant that I'm telling it the patient may have could change the protein. And so we call those in silico analysis. And over here, it's if it's benign, over here, if it's damaging. And they all have to be the same for us to use this as a line of evidence. And by itself, it's not enough. So this one, it's a little bit all over the place. So I couldn't use it for variant interpretation. This is also important because the type of variant, is it a misspelling or is it that there's a word missing? That also helps me in figuring this out. The other piece of evidence that we're talking about was using that family data for interpretation. And this can be very important for us because for some diseases that are very severe, we don't expect the biological parents from which we get our DNAs from to have the same variant because we would expect them to have symptoms. And for those diseases that I showed you, like the mitochondrial ones that are mostly recessive, we would expect variants from both sides of the family. That can increase the detection rate of the exome also by around 10%. So this can also be very powerful. So I usually recommend it, but it's definitely up to the patients and the families. So in this specific case, what we found out from this is that one of the variants came from mom. The other one, we knew that it didn't come from that, but that wasn't part of the testing. And so that made me think that the other variant did come from that, but did not was not enough to reclassify that uncertain variant. And so another way that I could think about that one variant is, are there other things that I can offer to try to see if that gene is not working well? And I'm here, this is a paper from Duchenne muscular dystrophy, which is a type of muscular dystrophy, where you can see the controls over here that have this nice staining around the cells. When you have the disease in the severe form, this is because there's a deletion and the protein is not made well, and you don't have good staining. And so this is a functional way for us to try to say, well, can I at least prove that the end product is not being made? So with mitochondrial diseases, sometimes this is what we try to do, but it may not be enough to give a diagnosis. So for this specific case, we did find that there was some alternative biochemical testing that we could offer to help interpret that result. This is different than what we would do for mitochondrial diseases, but it's a type of biochemical test. And what they saw is that what we were measuring was elevated and consistent with the diagnosis. So specifically in speaking about mitochondrial diseases, there can be some biochemical tests that we can do to try to help us with interpretation. The problem is that there's not a one biomarker or one biochemical test for everything that is precise enough, but it can increase our index of suspicion. And I'm sure that you've probably seen this before. I took this from the toolkit. But one of the things that we do is try to see if there's any tests where some of the labs may be elevated or not, or low, that may increase our suspicions. For instance, the lactate levels. And I don't know if you see it here, the elevated alanine levels, because the cells rely on using glycolysis. Those can be elevated if that's not working appropriately. And so those are like some of the extra things that I'm trying to look at in trying to understand if the mitochondria are working well. And then what used to be the previous gold standard was more those biochemical assays, but at the level of the tissue, usually that is involved, or the skeletal muscle was is the more common one, where we're trying to measure the products. Now, with pathology tissue studies, most of the times they don't give you a specific diagnosis, like in the genetics world, where we may be able to say this is the gene, this is the specific disease, but they may get you to a group. We also have to take into account that they are invasive, and people with mitochondrial diseases may be more sensitive to anesthesia too. Although the tissue of choice tends to be the muscle biopsy, we have to think of that heteroplasmy and are there levels in other body parts that we should be thinking about. Some of the things that you can look at is like this like light microscopy here. This is what people call ragged red fibers. This is less often seen in children. And you can see that these abnormal mitochondria are around the cells where they're not supposed to be. With electron microscopy, we can see like the mitochondria have an abnormal structure. With the biochemical assays of the complexes, it's like looking at the function of the mitochondria. For this particular one with the OxPHOS test, there's a 10 to 40% chance of helping establish a diagnosis. But it doesn't give you the specific diagnosis necessarily. So these would be things that I'd consider if I have variants, and I think the mitochondria is not working well to help me with interpretation, but I wouldn't use them usually right now as a standalone test. And the other thing that sometimes can help me is the addition of imaging studies. In this case, it's a type of MRI that also has spectroscopy where I can actually look at lactate, but at the level of the brain with this particular study. This is an example of not a mitochondrial disease, but one of my patients that allowed us to use their skin biopsy to actually send out to New Zealand to be studied by Dr. Robertson here, who's the last author on this paper. He had some symptoms that matched those of other people that had variants in this gene called filamin A. And we suspected it, but he didn't match the known clinical presentations to date. And when we spoke with the experts, we found out they had one other child in the whole world, also from the US, who had a similar type of variant. And they did functional studies, and they were able to prove that on the patients, they were not producing what they were supposed to. So you see here, the controls have this red, and the patients do not. And so they did some specific experiments to be able to prove that the variant in the gene that was uncertain was actually causing disease. I work on other functional studies through different institutions here in Georgia, and it takes a village to be able to put this together. This is one of the other areas that I am involved with, apart from metabolic diseases, which is differences in the blood vessels that we call vascular malformations. And what we're doing currently is taking the samples from the patients, which also need a tissue sample, and make patient-derived cells that then grow into like a little organ that then we can study. And so I and we work on these things, but it is not as easy to do this type, and it takes a long time to get results. The other thing that you and I can think of is collaborations. Sometimes people may have, and this is also for vascular anomaly specifically, but there may be people being able to do certain things. And this is a study done from cell-free DNA from blood samples for these particular conditions. And I was able to get an agreement between the institutions so that I could send them samples and get patient results. And so when I was asking about that collaboration, one of the things that I wanted to do is to be able to get an actual report that I could clinically then use to change management. So those are the things that I'm thinking about when I'm trying to establish collaborations with other people. So you see here, it says like as a service of this program, this is what we found. And that report was validated. Other things that we can use is AI. This is not something new. This phase two gene has been around for a long time. There's few metabolic mitochondrial conditions that have a specific facial phenotype, but there's a couple that I can name, like PDHA1. Oh, it says my battery's running low, but I am connected. Give me one second. That should be fixed. I'm sorry. But PDHA1, TMEM70. So sometimes I'll take a picture of the patient. This is a HIPAA compliant app. So although it is on my phone, it does not save any pictures to my phone. It has its own cloud. So, but it's very bizarre to be in front of a patient like, can I take a picture? And is my phone coming out? But it uses the features of people to help me identify. And just to show this example, I took a picture of a child who had a non-mitochondrial disease, and it said, hey, I suggest that he may have Kleefstra syndrome. By the time I got that exome 3 months later, the child had Kleefstra syndrome. So it can be used, and it can be powerful. This is just showing you that one of the things that we did with the 3Q29 program, I think it's cut off here at the top, is that we use human phenotype ontology, so specific terminology to help set up one of these for one of the patients that we studied as well. And so we took pictures of, I think, over 11 of the patients You need at least 11 to be able to put these together, and then controls so that we could build one of these for 3Q29 deletion, and it's now on the website. So now, the last thing that I wanted to mention was current treatment strategies for genetic conditions, which include mitochondrial diseases. We know this is complex and multidisciplinary, but in going back to talking about establishing a diagnosis and then trying to get to treatment, right? We know that they're not available for most genetic conditions, and maybe some may attenuate the disease but not cure it. There's many adjunctive therapies and treatments that are usually needed. We know the response is variable. We know it doesn't treat all the manifestations the same way. We know that for some conditions, we may need newborn screening to have an early diagnosis to be able to treat. And that there's many phases of clinical trials. And this is hard to perform. One of the first things that we need may be preclinical data, which may include animal models. And then from there, have different phases of clinical trials to establish first that things are safe, even in people who do not have a specific diagnosis, and then show that they are effective and that the outcome is better with the drug than without the drug. So one of the things that I've been involved with is an animal model that helped do two things. One, confirmed the impact of an uncertain variant on patients who have a type of it's called neuronal ceroid lipofuscinosis, which is also like a metabolic disease where they can have seizures, developmental delays, retinopathy. They built the mouse model with the variants of one of my patients, and they could show that there were differences at the level of the retina. And the idea is that, okay, we've proven these variants are different and cause differences at the mouse model, but because the mouse model now has features similar to the human, can we use this assay now? Or can we use this mouse as a tool to try different drugs? So that's one of the end points here. We have not gotten to that point yet, but this is one of the things that I've been involved with. And so, in thinking of that and how long the process is, one of the other things that I've been involved with have been more phase three clinical trials. We do have a clinical trial center here at Emory with many trials studying diseases open at the same time. But you guys at home can go through clinicaltrials.gov and look for a specific disease, look for a specific type of therapy, and see if there's anything available. Registries can also come up here. And one of the ones that I work with is for a urea cycle disorder called arginase 1 deficiency. People with this condition are oftentimes now diagnosed through newborn screening, but it can be missed through newborn screening and can present similar to someone with spasticity, like a cerebral palsy, but it doesn't start at birth. It usually starts a few years after birth. They can have seizures, they can have growth differences. So this was the first time we were giving. It's an enzyme that it doesn't work well to break down something in the body. So we were giving for the first time this enzyme replacement therapy. This is one of the children in the clinical trial that we had in one of our publications. But it has not been approved by FDA yet, although it's been submitted. The BLA was supposed to come through like the information now in May. The good news is that it was approved in the EU. So it's now approved, at least in Europe, for the treatment of these diseases. And I am hopeful that it can improve long-term care for these patients. And that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you for listening and for inviting me here today. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you so much for giving us a whirlwind of things to think about and to try to help better understand how you approach these rare variants and connecting a lot of dots. So I just really appreciate you taking the time. We've had several questions coming through. So I want to try to go ahead and tackle some of those. Just to let everybody know, with certain specific questions, we might have to kind of walk around those questions. I may ask them specifically just so I don't lose anything as to what she can answer, but there might be ways to kind of connect offline about certain questions. So our first question, is there a way to learn more about a specific variant? This particular patient is rare of the rare. She is like one of, I think, Well, she didn't put it in here, but I know her. But so she has like maybe one or two in the world with her particular variant.
Wow.
And so when you're in that situation, how do you learn about your variant? And is at that point, is the best thing for you to do to contact a researcher? Is that a possibility?
That's a great question, and that's a hard one. I think each institution is a little different. Each state, if we're talking here in the US, is maybe a little different. I think that one of the first things is I would probably start by contacting the person who sent the testing, so that they can speak to the variant and what is known. Sometimes in a meeting with a patient and family, there's so much information that we're trying to convey in a single visit that we may not be going, like I was showing you, like row by row. And this is how common this is, and this is how uncommon this is, and this is and but another meeting with like the counselors or the geneticists may be helpful with some of that. And then with maybe their help, or even if you find someone online, then the next step would, I think, be research for something that is ultra rare. There's two different things there. One is it a gene known to cause disease, right? Because sometimes you have a rare variant in a rare gene where the gene in itself may be of uncertain significance. And so that may require its own thing. Or is it a known gene that has a rare variant? And could there be any other of these biochemical tests, imaging, or anything to help support the diagnosis? And so depending on that, which route, if it's a not a known gene at all, that's when those gene matcher and other things, that's when I would upload it to try to see, are there other people who've had variants in this gene? Like I put one recently on a gene called DNA H10 for something completely different than mitochondrial diseases. And I just got an email yesterday saying you have no hits. So it'll periodically update you if there's a match or not. And so that could also be one of the first steps. But I would probably suggest to start with the person who did the testing. If I know of people that can help me, like I've worked with the CHOP group for some of my patients, because I know my own limitations and I know what I can do in the center I am stationed at. I will reach out to them too, or I may bring it up to the family. Hey, have you thought of traveling here or, participating on this other thing?
That sounds like it is appropriate, like if you're working with your geneticist to ask them, like, here, like if you've done your own research and you found a researcher that is interested in your gene, like asking them to contact the researcher about your case. I'm willing to sign the paperwork that needs to make this happen. Or is there a collaboration that might be possible?
Yeah,
And
and that gives a, because we don't want to think about it this way, but that can also give like a certain gain to the person in front of you. It may be something to help with getting them engaged. Let's say I said that, oh, this is being recorded.
Well, it's complicated. I think it's complicated as patients because we recognize, right, that geneticists see hundreds and hundreds of patients, right? And if we're one of one for them, sometimes it's hard to know what that balance is of bringing information to clinic and trying to figure out how to work together. And then when do you get to a point where you just contact a researcher yourself? Like if there's not, and you're right, different countries have different capabilities of doing this and collaborative work and stuff. But I think you're right. I think it's a good to set a precedent. It's always good to ask the question, because collaboration is so important in genetics.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of us. So chances are you know the person that someone else is reaching out to. I think we are very accepting that we, one, don't know everything, and two, don't have all the resources to do everything. So I think that we like collaborations in general. I love if someone else can help me out with things that I know that I can't do. I cannot study the cells myself, but maybe someone else can help me out. So that's a good one.
So there's been several questions that have come in regards to AI, and you kind of touched base on it a little bit, some of these systems that You can use, and I try to write them down. So, like the Gene Matcher, I don't know if that's considered AI or the Franklin tool. But are there other systems that when that geneticists use, and when they're trying to figure out if a VUS has changed, or and or if you have a patient with a VUS and you're watching progression and you think that maybe this is becoming significant, what do you do with that information to help get that information out there to other systems or other people who might be using AI to do their classification?
Yeah, there's some labs that are already using AI as part of their bioinformatic pipelines. So some of the labs already use it to help with interpretation and to sort out some of the details of variants. So that is embedded in some of the labs already and their bioinformatic pipelines. There's other places where we can use to look at variants like Franklin, but there's ClinVar, and like Franklin already pulls in some of that information. But if I wanted to look at those additional websites myself, many of these are more like databases rather than AI. I can definitely look into it in more detail. Many of the labs already have it, within the report in a way that, I can quickly look at it, but I like to double check. Anyhow, I think most of us will, also look at other sources. For if someone has, let's say, a progression and there's a variant and I'm concerned, I periodically check. I think that's one of the nice things of going back to genetics. Every time that someone is going to come see us and there's a VUS, and I usually follow people if there's nothing I'm managing, maybe every year or every other year, I'll myself recheck the variant. So even if it's not updated, maybe on the report, because we don't have a new report, I will still go back to the data sets. Or like I will periodically recheck the variant. So that's a nice thing that when you are coming back, I see before I see any patient, usually a few days before, I review the whole thing again. And that's also why we ask so many questions. I think we're like, and what happened new? And were there changes in the family? Anyone else born? Anyone with new symptoms? Because also there's such a variability, and that is part of that information that I'm pulling in to help me interpret it. If with that I can't make a change in the classification, but I'm very suspicious, again, I may take steps forward. I may be, ordering additional testing, et cetera, if I think it's required. If not, that's when I'm usually reaching out for a collaboration.
That's really helpful because I think sometimes when you have a VUS, well, first of all, maybe a patient doesn't realize they should still be seeing their geneticist on occasion, like for those evaluations or the why. If they say, okay, we'll see you back in a year, like it's helpful sometimes to know the why, like and why it's important to do these reassessments, and that at some point it might lead to an answer, not just for yourself, but maybe for somebody else as well. And you also mentioned too just the difference between AI and these database systems, that they're not the same thing. And I think that's important to clarify because it's kind of hard to understand.
I think it's very hard to understand, and there are people using AI also to help. Let's say I found this condition, I found these type of genes. Are there any medications used for anything else for this specific, pathway of the genes? And I've used it that way myself to try it out. I mean, you have to take things with a grain of salt. So you still have to do your back research, even if AI brings up something. But those are things that we can try to do, and I think people are going to try to do it too independently. So I would just make sure the references are correct. And when you were saying about bringing this information forward, I think it's also the way that information is brought up to a physician, because we want to help each other and we want to have a relationship. As long as both sides have good communication and we're respectful, I think it's taken in a good way and not a bad way. I mean, I can't vouch for everyone, but I think it's also about how things are done.
Yeah, no, that's important. There's been some questions in regards to, okay, let's take a step back because you mentioned, the importance of family and the importance of family analysis. Can you talk a little bit about why that's important. Like, if I come to you and I have a VUS and I don't have the ability to access family information, like, why does that change things, you know, versus if I'm able to bring my mom in and she has the same VUS? Like, what connections are you able to make that might send you over the threshold of being able to get a diagnosis?
That's a great question. It depends on how a specific condition is inherited too, and the type of genetic change. So for those cases that I was showing you where I was using the families, those conditions that are recessive, what I was trying to prove was that one variant was coming from mom and one variant was coming from dad. So I was looking at how the dynamics of the variant were within the family. The other things I may be looking at, let's say that it's a recessive condition, so we don't expect parents to have it, but other people in that same child's generation may be affected. So let's say a sibling now has the symptoms and also has both variants, and there's an unaffected sibling that has one or none. That may increase my level of suspicion. For some dominant conditions that tend to be very severe, if you had the variant, you only need one to cause disease. If you had it, I would expect symptoms. Now, some of the symptoms for mitochondrial diseases may not be severe enough to be recognized clinically. So I may still be doing assessments clinically to see if someone has a symptom or may show up later in life. So they may not have the symptoms yet. So that can make it a little also harder. Like an example is PEO, the progressive external ophthalmoplegia that can present in adulthood. They can present later on. I mean, although they tell you like above this age, but you know, there's a range. So someone may have a variant and not have symptoms. But if many people have the variant and they don't have symptoms at a specific ages, then that decreases my level of suspicion. For the mitochondrial DNA, honestly, that's the hardest one because of those heteroplasmy levels and do I have the right tissue to study? So that one is very hard to do. But sometimes if I have a VUS in one of those, the heteroplasmy level is low and many other family members have it and don't have the symptoms that I would expect, it does decrease my suspicion. And then the last part of the family is the family planning. So that's where also it comes in. For me as the clinician is if there's one that I'm suspicious of, are there other people at risk of having it, but also having children with it? And so that's the other reason why I'm usually counseling around that.
Helpful. I know we're getting close to 1:15. Do we have a couple more minutes to be able to answer a couple more questions?
The other one that I would say is that you guys can go into the clinical trials website yourself and look for your condition. For those that have a registry or a trial, you don't have to wait to talk to your provider. They have the emails there of the coordinators of the trials. Those are people that you can freely reach out to because it's designed that way. The clinical trials, even the registries are designed that way that you yourself can initiate it. Like the research collaborations where there's an N of one and you have to reach out to a very specific, those are the ones where usually you need the intermediary. But for the clinical trials, you don't. You can be yourself the one taking charge. So those are some that I would probably tell people, hey, periodically check. There may be something about it.
Patient asked specifically if sequencing.com is a valid genetic testing site. You mentioned earlier the importance of making sure, you know, that 23andMe is like more recreational and, you know, the importance of talking with the geneticist. I don't know if you can speak to that one or how do you know that you're getting a test that's valid?
That's a great one. I do not know that company well enough to be able to say. I have had patients actually who've used it. I've seen reports where they have other things that I don't usually use clinically, like longevity things, because I don't know how to interpret them. That's the reality. Like doing a test that I cannot interpret myself and know the validity of is very hard. So some people will bring me some metabolic tests done in labs that are not maybe certified. So usually they have something called CAP and CLIA certifications, which tell me that they're done in a rigorous manner, that they're using good reference ranges. It's labs that are also read by people who are boarded in the specialty, they should be borders. So there's cytogeneticists, there's molecular genetic, there's bioinformaticians. There's so many different people behind the scenes that we're not seeing. And I want to know that their qualifications are also good. And so that's oftentimes why I'm also choosing specific labs that our patients go through. And I wouldn't say like, oh, this lab or that lab. Sometimes it also depends on insurance for me to be able to send. But in general, I use like some sets of labs that I've been in contact with them. We know the representatives, we know the technology they're using, we know it's not done in a weird way where insurance is not used in the appropriate way. So those are the things from the clinical side that I'm thinking about. So I cannot specifically talk about that one company just because I don't know.
No, I mean, I think that you bring a really good point that it's not a yes or no question. There's a lot that goes into the decision making as to why institutions use specific places for their testing. And there's a lot as patients that we may or may not know, like what goes into that decision making process. And so ask your clinician, why are they using a particular, why do they like to use a particular place? And I think that helps to bring clarity. I'm going to throw one large question at you towards the end, because we've had a couple of patients reach out via the chat in regards to one patient is a carrier of POLGY1, and their son has been diagnosed with Alport syndrome, and they have variants of unknown significance. So they're curious if you've had experience with POLGY. Another patient asked if you have had any experience with variants of unknown significance related to the TWNC gene. And so I'm curious if you can speak to that at all. I'll also want to put a plug in there. We do have a presentation with Dr. Copeland that we did several months ago, who researches disease maintenance, mitochondrial disease maintenance conditions, including POLGY and TWNC. So I'll try to find the people that asked that and send that to them. But they would like your opinion about those things in regards to VUSs. And
Yeah,
how
I
would you
do have.
approach it if you got a patient with these VUSs? How would you figure out how to help them?
Okay, and I know that there's a lot of more information for POLGY. I do have patients with POLGY. I was just opening up some of the information here in front of me on my other computer. The patient I had was one who had more like developmental delays and then started having the liver problems later on. And we've had many people with variants in the POLGY gene because that gene can be inherited in a dominant or recessive way. Sometimes when you have a VUS, we don't know if the VUS is for the recessive form or the dominant form. So that's one like added extra level where I've had maybe difficulties with variant interpretation for that one gene. Because from what you just said about this person has a phenotype that looks like Alpers. I would think if you did that variant segregation, one is from mom, one is from dad, and all everything else falls in place, that potentially could be the reason. But there's other conditions that can overlap. So I cannot speak, specifically about the variants on this family or not, but it would make me suspicious, is what I would say, if I knew that information, like the phenotype matches. There's biallelic variants, and parents don't have other features of the dominant forms. More with we were just talking about the eye stuff, those types of things. So that could make me suspicious. I do not have. I think I heard Twinkle. I don't have patients with that one. I do have patients with SERS1 and Sukla, I think. So I do have other the may present like with similar conditions, but not with that part. Particular one, so I do not have a lot of firsthand knowledge on that condition, but I've had patients with poultry.
Are you familiar at this point if a variant in the MTND5 is suspicious for Elhan plus? I don't know if you've seen Elhan plus patients.
I don't see many of them. They present more to the eye clinic and to the adult geneticist, just how it is and some of the triggers that can be there for the eye symptoms. So I don't have as much just off the top of my head. I would have to look into it a little deeper to be able to answer better.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sanchez. Thank you for staying on with us extra time. We really, really appreciate it. Thank you for the community for asking amazing questions and for sharing your information. And if I didn't get to your question today, feel free to email me at sharry@mitoaction.org. And a couple of you have put your emails in the chat, and I will try to follow up with you because we have so many questions. And I think that's one of the things I love about science is that you ask one question and you end up with five more. You might
Yes.
find a singular answer and then 20 more questions. And so thank you for being a scientist who asks a lot of questions and asks the hard questions and walks with your patients through that, Dr. Sanchez. We
No,
really
thank you
appreciate it.
guys for being here. I appreciate your time too.
All right, until next time.
Until next time, bye-bye.
Bye.